Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Hart. I think it would make a very fine transition if I could give you a concrete instance to sustain Mr. MacDonald's argument this morning. There used to be a play party game called Hog Drover, which I will sing you the little song that goes with it, so it should seem to be concrete evidence of something that some sinner might think that a historian has just got up. It goes like this. Hog drovers, hog drovers, hog drovers we are, a-courting a daughter so sweet and so fair. Can we get a lodging here or here? Can we get a lodging here? Oh, here is my daughter that's set by my lap. No pig stealing drover can get her from Pap. You can't get a lodging here or here. You can't get a lodging here. Well, pretty your daughter, but ugly yourself. You'll travel on further and set on the shelf. We don't want a lodging here or here. We don't want a lodging here. Also, my father felt that society is a much better society when it raises cattle and animals. He says it takes more sense to raise them than just plant a row of cotton. So there again, it stains Mr. MacDonald somewhat. But my father was a stout fellow. In his day, if women were sucking their children, they didn't think they'd get pregnant. My father got to be such a big boy, he had to stand up on a stool with a little dirty hat on his head and neigh. Well, my friend had a hat and said, he's such a gentleman, I know he tipped his hat and he got in it. Now, they took their staff to this way. No, it's not. You can't hear, raise your hand. They took their stand, the agrarian view after 50 years. This title is to me ambiguous. Of the 12 agrarians who wrote the symposium, I take my stand, only three are alive. Robert Penn Warren, the poet and novelist, Lyle Lanier, a psychologist and former executive vice president of the University of Illinois, and myself, a writer and reader of fiction. I don't presume to speak either for Warren or Lanier, and I don't know how to address myself to myself in the past tense. Perhaps I'm not here at all. Secretly, I've had a feeling. I was killed at the Battle of Rice's Crossroads. Taking the bullet meant for General Forrest. You understand, it was Forrest, who, if he'd been left, could have been decisive in winning the war of the Northern Rebellion. Too often, Confederate forces won the field only to retreat later on. Bryce's Crossroads, fought in Mississippi, is a perfect battle. It should be an example of such in the textbooks of war colleges, and no doubt is. Forrest combined the forces at the right time, defeated an enemy with odds of 2-1 against him, and then pursued the enemy and drove him out of the state, not to speak of the seizure of supplies, which was large and needed. So perhaps it will be all right to speak of myself in third person, along with my companions in arms, who must of necessity be so addressed, if what you see here is not me, but my ghostly presence. But if I'm a ghost, what are you? And what then are all those good men and true who find their belief disembodied? For as God, no idea, principle, or belief is ever defeated. Men are. except those men who continue to believe and take the proper risk. I cite you from Thermopylae. As military science and tactics is never either defensive or offensive, but both, so no surrender need be final, not even unconditional surrender. There was a moment when the agrarian sculpture, a particular moment when the country suffered the 1929 stock market crash. The book coming out after that made us seem prophets. We did not so see ourselves in the writing of it. None of us was a politician or intended, I think, any pragmatic action. We were protesting an unhappy condition of Southern affairs and a continuing conquest. Today it is clear to me at least that we were better prophets than we knew. I don't feel that any of us at the time could have imagined that the conditions we protested could become so rapidly worsened. So, after the crash, for a while at least, we had hope of making the word flesh. It was a lot of fun. We addressed one another as general. I hope you understand facetiously, but not quite. The Depression was upon us, and it was headed. I didn't have a dime in my pocket for 2 years. I tried to quit on horseback, but that's a poor way to do it, I tell you. People were stealing corn in broad open daylight, and my father would turn his head. I know of a fireman in Trenton, New Jersey, who rode his bicycle into the country and stole apples to feed his family. William Dodd, a historian and ambassador to Germany, tried to persuade Roosevelt that he might do well to listen to the agrarians. Instead, he got the dollar a year man. I spoke to Senator Bankhead. All he could come up with was 40 acres and a mule. There were mules then. They're curiosities now. Before I go on, I must remind myself how pervasive was a growing acceptance of the new materialism we attacked as industrialism. The South had prospered during the First World War. In the euphoria of victory, there was a general feeling that we were back in the Union. The New South propaganda of progress everywhere said as much. And most of the media of news and public information took it for granted. Farming was looked down upon. Tired of poverty and honest work, the young began to desert the land and go to town. And in town, the ambitious youth took the trains to New York City, as did many young men from the West. The educational world began to change its curriculum. The chancellor of Vanderbilt University announced at a crucial moment of an agrarian fight that he wanted to graduate bankers, not writers or farmers. Rumor had it that the English building, in the worst you ever saw, ordered by him, was to be as much like a factory as possible, and the architects obliged. It was not the church's thanksgiving that we chanted, and with no disrespect to you, Mr. Marr. A New England holiday was universally celebrated as the national thanksgiving. This salvation of the Puritan fathers after their hard winter was instilled into the minds of Southern children as the salvation of their founding fathers. One of my projects in kindergarten was cutting out and painting turkeys and tall hatted men with bibs to paste in front of a log cabin made out of twigs. At home, I was Red Uncle Remus, but in public, it was John Alden. Why don't you speak for yourself, John, that we were red? We were not told that Captain John Smith, sailing the Atlantic coast, brought smallpox to the Indians at Plymouth and so let the Puritans land in safety. Always, it was a New England story which concerned the genesis of the nation, not the other John, John Rolfe, who was saved by the Indian maiden, Pocahontas. Their subsequent marriage made an elevating and romantic story of amity between the races. No teacher knew enough to reveal, or said as much, to reveal the history and historic meaning of this incident. It was the first English recorded instance of the Indian woman's preference for the European. The betrayal of her tribe for the white man's favors was a constant element in the pattern of Indian defeat. Nancy Ward, a beloved woman of the Cherokees, saw nothing wrong in sitting in council where all the secrets were brought forth and living with one of the enemies. Her betrayal indicates the complexity of the Indian mind, for she never left the council and remained beloved and respected. Whoever wins an Indocine war, as Davis and others have said, writes the history of that war, and unfortunately, the textbooks as well. There were too many stories, lost in diaries and obscure history, about the settlements in Middle Tennessee, for example, both of Indians and Americans, which would have told our young of stamina and courage. The attack on the stations around Nashville, the skillet and the kettle at the bend of the Tennessee River, on account of that one man, Spencer, who lived in the arm of a hollow sycamore alone during the hardest winter that country had known, with only half a skinning knife for protection. For food and protection. It must have been some tree, for he was so big a man, a French trader, seeing his footprint, jumped into the Cumberland River and ran and swam away. He thought he was seeing a monstrous bear. Later, at a militia meeting, muster, Spencer intervened between two young men who were fighting. One tried to get rough with him, whereupon he picked him up and threw him over a 9-foot fence surrounding the stockade. The man called back, "If you just throw my horse over, Mr. Spencer, I'll be getting on my way." There are a number of these tales, and they carry the truth about a history, the quality of a tradition, as well as more formal documents. It was not long, however, before some of us, at least, suffered a disillusion. It was not so clear that we were back in the Union. There were two incidents which had a good deal to do with this, I think. At least, they gave some propulsion to reforming our opinion and informing our judgment. One was the Dayton and Monkey trial in Tennessee. The trial concerned a law forbidding the teaching of evolution in the schools of the state. This law was loudly proclaimed as an attack on academic freedom. Our philosophy professor, Dr. Herbert Sanborn, a New Englander, almost alone at Vanderbilt, saw the truth and exposed the fallacy in scientism arguments. I first met Alan Tate in New York City. We had once began discussing the trial as a liberal attack on our traditional inheritance. Now I see it as an advanced phase of reconstruction. Maybe they're one and the same thing. After the economic exploitation of the South, this religious attack on the Southern spirit seemed to have a double purpose: to denigrate us before the country and the world, make us laughed at as backward and ignorant. But the real aim was more insidious, a forced acceptance of belief in a secular instead of a divine order of the universe. Practically, this would have meant a total instead of an economic dominance by the Northeast. But the soul is not so easily traduced, especially of the people who live by or close to the land. These people are religious by nature, because they enjoy and suffer nature, how they starve. Of course, the defense of Dayton was inadequate, depending as it did upon a strict construction of the Bible and its literal fallacy. but the level of tax is equally fallacious. That scientism, there is no such thing as science, only sciences, are the only truth about man and nature. Along with this came H.L. Mencken's journalistic description of the South as the Sahara and the Bozar. This is like the thief who robs the house the second time and complains that the owners do not eat the silver. How far such calumnies influence the swell, I won't try to say except for myself. One of the dangers of this kind of discussion is inflicting your own responses upon your fellows, who certainly spoke for themselves. It set me to studying American and Southern history, about which I knew little or nothing. I kept at it for 7 years, with Frank Owsley, a beloved husband, to guide me, one of our professional historians whose life work was to replace bias or inaccurate account by the truth. Soon Tate was writing the biographies of Stonewall Jackson and Jefferson Davis, Robert Penn Warren, a biography of John Brown, and I was working with on forward. At any rate, all the writers were Southern, and most of them, by accident, were associated with Vanderbilt University. These men were already known or had become distinguished in their proper occupations, whether it is history or psychology or literature. Their agrarian writings merely display their common cultural inheritance, which is Christian and European. Let me quote a paragraph from the Statement of Principles as forewords I'll take my stand. I'm doing this for a purpose. Opposed to the industrial society is the agrarian, this is a quote, which does not stand in particular need of definition. An agrarian society is hardly one that has no use at all for industry, for professional vocation, for scholars and artists, and for the life of cities. Technically, perhaps, an agrarian society is one in which agriculture is a leading vocation, whether for wealth, for pleasure, or for prestige, a form of labor that is pursued with intelligence and leisure, and it becomes the goal to which the other farms approach as well as they may. Now that's been clarified today. Surely then, it must be taken that a poet, a farmer, a banker, a historian, a school teacher, must live in a certain place and time, and so exhibit the kind of belief and behavior defined by the manners and mores of that time and place. It was not necessary to be a farmer, to be agrarian. It was merely the basic occupation of a commodity-producing society. The liberal cartoons attacking showed us that our heads under a mule's tail, our lone pretty, are necessary, as George Washington called it, with a half moon cut over the door and the door closed. It left to the imagination what was behind the door. Adam Tate remarked that he preferred an indoor commode so long as he didn't have to kneel down and worship it before using it. Only the liberal could confuse equipment with the thing itself. But then the liberal is always promising to relieve us of our common ills at somebody else's expense. He is the propagandist of the power we oppose. It is an old fight, and the agrarians were not the first to enter it. This is no time to re-argue the case. The books are there to be read, and read in light of our present circumstances. I do want to emphasize that agrarianism was not an effort to reconstitute an ideal state, a new utopia, unless, in the sense of Sir Thomas More's utopia, an allegory criticizing the King's English and European policy, an outright statement was lost in his head much earlier. The agrarian effort was towards the preservation of an inherited way of life, a way which was threatened but still in existence. I said it was an old fight, Napoleon tried to restore the legitimacy of kingship, but London, the center of international banking, defeated. At St. Helena, he told Las Cassines, quoting, "Agriculture is the soul, the foundation of the kingdom. Industry ministers to the comfort and happiness of the people. Foreign trade is the superabundance. It allows the due exchange of the surplus of agriculture and home industry. These last ought never to be subordinate to foreign trade. This country's policy is the virtue of it. Foreign trade first, industry, agriculture a poor third. Each day news reports witness to the folly of this order." Shortly after the American Revolution, the cogent opponent to what he called the paper and patronage aristocracy was John Taylor of Caroline County, Virginia. His question was, why set up in this country the same power we fought a war to be free of? He was speaking against banking and a central government. He was a Jeffersonian, but more agrarian and more lucid than Jefferson. He refused to put any hope in man, but always in principle. In 1803, he published Arator's New Farming, a collection of essays on farming and politics. The thesis is this: agriculture and politics are the sources of wealth and power, which number 90% of the people then the farmers are connected with. Both contain internal good principles, but both are subject to practical deterioration. If agriculture is good and the government bad, we may have wealth and slavery. If the government is good and agriculture bad, liberty and poverty. So, let me redenda this. Say from 1940 to 1974, the number of farms in the United States declined from approximately 6 million to a little over 2 million. 62% of our family units, as they say now. Since the Second World War, 30 million people have left the country for the city. You don't need but one wrong idea to destroy a state. I'm not talking statistics, but this great acceleration of such widespread loss of farms and family sustains my argument, which is this. At the time we wrote, there were enough families living on the land and enough small town and city privately owned businesses to counterbalance somewhat the great industrial might, which was a fact and had to be reckoned with. If our proposal had been listened to, this necessary industry might have been contained. At least it might have been accelerated, as the past has done. Might not have grown into the only idea of the kind of life everybody must be forced to accept. A family, and I mean its kin and connection, too, thrives best on some fixed location, which holds the memories of this past generation by the ownership of farms or even family businesses. I had a friend who was a fine basketball player, and in those days he had on a double bed. We were somewhere and we were going to bed together, and he told me he'd had the 7 years in. Well, I said, "I'm going to get my pillow here and sleep on the floor." Now he says, "We had so many brothers and sisters and cousins, my family all got together and scratched it out in 3 weeks." So you can see the families had some value. Yeah. Not only sentimental memories, but skills passed down, and a knowledge of the earth tender, and a knowledge particularly of the bloodstream, so as to be warned and prepared for what to expect in behavior. Industry today uproots. It's like the army without having army's raison d'etre. Promotion, except among the basic workers, means pulling up roots and being sent elsewhere with the promise of a better car and another room to the house. The children, just as they're making friends and getting used to school, must begin all over again somewhere else. This is a modification of the Spartan state, which reduced the family to a minimal role. The most irresponsible of our critics accuse us of the self-indulgence of nostalgia. of foisting on our readers a myth. By myth was meant something that never existed. All societies are sustained by a myth. Such a myth is a necessity metaphysical, but it is not this kind of a myth the critics had in mind. The critic, he has mischosen his word. He meant fantasy, something that had no grounding in fact. Unfortunately, for this kind of argument, many of us are historians, and in Frank Owsley, his wife, we had the best of professional historians. I speak of Owsley rather than Nixon, because it was he and his wife, Harriet, who exposed the alien myths about the South that is composed of large plantations, old master sipping juleps while the slaves sang. And on the fringe, the one bale that cotton farmers called poor white. He simply went to the census record where the facts were. Also diaries and county records. But the federal census carried particular authority. One instance of this, presumably, the Black Belt counties would be the area of the large plantation. Now the census taker went down the road. He stopped at this farm and that farm and so forth, on down the way. The owls had discovered the greatest diversity in ownership. Large plantations by moderate-sized farms, small farms, a plantation of 2,000 acres with no slaves, a man owning slaves and no land. I won't go on, as the authority is here to correct the amplifier news, if she is willing. You see, the South was never solid until after the Civil War. Defeat made it solid. The misunderstanding, even among the most sympathetic critics, like Lewis Rubin, has assumed that a commodity-producing society, such as the South and West, had not a chance of sustaining itself before the successive triumph of the financial corporate role of money. And this kind of money is always international. They were vague about this corporate rule, but they accepted as absolute the ex post facto assumption of the relative poverty of the southern farm and its ultimate doom. The confusion lies just here. The communities composed of families with real property and private businesses still existed. The fight was on, but the outcome was uncertain. The depression was a heavy blow. Cotton cost 7 cents a pound to grow, and it brought on what is essentially the world market 5 cents. The only answer Roosevelt's government could give was plow into one-fourth of your labor, cotton, corn, hogs, and cattle. This was the most immoral fire ever handed down from afar in this country, as it was at the time. Destroy your handicraft and life on abstract stock market principles. Where was the Joseph to talk of lean and fat gear? Throw away instead of destroy. The communities still existed, even after the First World War. I was there. I lived in them. Most of the towns in the South and cities, too, lived by the country. My argument in two essays is this. The small farm upholds the state. I didn't give any number of acres. What I meant was a family-owned and operated place. If the place has no mortgage, you live in a dwelling house without paying rent. If you plow with a team, you grow your own sugar. You grow most of your food. You do grow crops for money, but you are not completely in the money economy. You live at home with some security, if anybody ever does. And you are part of a living community with other families in your situation. Ease some better than others, as always will be the case. Now witness the county seat. I'm speaking from experience again. All the roads radiating from Murfreesboro, where I live, from the seat were privately owned. They had toll gates every 5 miles, and the pass through cost so much, I think a buggy was 25, head of sheep and cattle so much. I used to go with my father to collect tolls, and the money, all coins, would be stacked in order, silver dollars, half dollars, quarters, down to dimes and nickels, and they all smelled of snuff. There were very few paper bills. This means that you didn't leave home either. You lived in a community with a radius of, say, 5 miles. This lasted almost until I went to college. The automobile was in its infancy. It was a toy for those who could buy. The ladies wore veils and all dust coats when the machine, as it was called, took you out for a short spin. People would call and ask if you were going to bring it out. It scared their mothers from carriage horses. And rightly so, it was the horses' doom. But it took some years before it broke up the community. 30 miles an hour was fast. The roads were not fit for speed. It took the greater part of the day to go from Huntsville, Alabama to Gunnersville, 40 miles away. Punctures were frequent. Our mud hole with brushes would delay you for maybe an hour. And you could find somebody to hitch up his team and pull you out. Of course, unless the team was obviously nearby and the hand held out. My father had a Fordson tractor. It could break 4 acres a day, but so could a good team of mules. He used it for disking, as broken ground is hard on animals. This was for corn silk, a 1,200-acre place, which the TVA stole and covered up with water. The family farm, not the corn silk I talked about, was dismissed as a subsistence farm. In the first place, there's no such thing as a subsistence farm. That is an adjective used by a voice who thinks milk comes out of bottles, a possibly of land so poor that no insurance company will give it a mortgage. But even this is no subsistence farm. Even this has its place in society. If it has little money and no credit to buy advertised products, it still had a life of its own. When the TVA began to build all those dams, covering up the best, making a permanent flood of the best land to control flood, it had to buy a little place near Muscle Shoals, Alabama. This place was so poor, it had no mortgage against it, but the shack did have a chimney whose fire had not gone out in 100 years. Eminent domain or not, the TVA had to move that chimney, the cold covered and hot, to its new location. The point is not that the move cost more than the price of the farm. The point is, in the mirage of history, fire on the hearth has been the symbol of the home. Neolithic man, according to Kumar Swami, across the museum, identified the column of smoke that rose from the hearth to disappear from view through a hole in the roof to the axis of the universe. I saw in this lover an image of the heavenly door, and in hearth the navel of the earth. The man who cherished that chimney and forced the sovereign power to desert it was not a man who thought much of comfort. That euphemism which disguises the perfidious intention of turning man into an appetite to be perpetually bloated by some new appeal of an expanding economy, expanding until the resources on the earth and beneath it are exhausted. In 1928, Alan Tate, his wife and child, and I traveled in a second-hand Ford called Old 97 from New York to Alabama, going over the battlefield. There were no interstates, maybe the Pennsylvania Turnpike, but many narrow paved roads, roads of gravel, all rocky places. The outskirts of Philadelphia ended easier in the country, with its farms and not just Amish either. Today, from Trenton to Philadelphia, there's a flow of houses which obliterates the state line, and at night, one long blur of light. So through Maryland into Virginia, we camped by the side of the road or in a farmer's lot and picked his turnip greens and cooked them in a pot with sour bandit. I knew how to make a hoe cake. The water and greens were free, as was the campground. If we felt we could afford it, we would stop in the village or some courthouse with buildings about it and eat a lunch for 35 cents. If it was 45, we might go on. There was only one tourist camp the entire way. No building, but a common washroom and commode. This was outside Richmond. We pitched the pup tents under a great tree. When invited, we would wash and dress and go into town and be elegantly entertained. The contrast was refreshing both ways. The night watchman was the great nephew of General John Bankhead Magruder, late of the Confederacy. The superintendent was the great nephew of General A.P. Hill of the Army of Northern Virginia, that general whose name was called out in the dying speech of both Lee and Jackson. This was a familiar word all of us were born in, and I hope I'm making it clear that now I'm not speaking only of the Southern terrain. Later, I went on alone into Mississippi, where forests often rode the battle. I can't believe it had changed much from war days. Going through the back country to Tupelo, I stopped to inquire the way. Teams were hitched about the courthouse fence. A political meeting was afoot in the yard. The patriarchs, all in black hats and white beards, sat on the platform with their hands on the slick knobs that hit the stick. It was obvious that little folly would take place in their presence. Shooting, possibly, but no folly. I was asked to take out and join the crowd. I was not asked to park the floor. I thanked the possible host and told him I was running late. Could he direct me to Tupelo? Down the road, he said, I would come to a widow woman's house where I was to turn to the left. I thanked him and backed out. I had no trouble finding the widow woman's house. It had no stove going in the yard. I've often asked myself, why was it that so few people, whose very being was at stake, failed to listen to us, I suppose? Those I knew of would agree with it. I think I know the reason now. Nobody could imagine the world they were born in, and lived in, and were still living in, could disappear. And it has. As my final word, I think we should have found a larger word than agrarian, for it is this whole country's Christian inheritance that was threatened, and still is. But let there be no misunderstanding. We are still Christians, we are not Mohammedans. Only we have reached Christian satanic faith. I can't believe that any society is strong which holds physical comfort as its best quest. There is only one comfort, and it is the only thing that has been promised, that the gates of hell will not finally prevail.